Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at putnam.com/529. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Tis the season, in case you hadn't heard. The quarterly flow of corporate profit reports today. No surprise, the banks are doing fine. Also, Walmart gets small, and Elmore Leonard on what makes a good bad guy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 13th of October today. And the fall 2010 bank earnings season began with a bang this morning. J.P. Morgan Chase beat everybody's guesses with a 23% increase in profits. It set aside less money for potential credit card losses because, the bank says, people are getting better at keeping up with their payments. However, profits from its investment banking business were down, as were returns from mortgage banking. Those are details that matter to J.P. Morgan and its shareholders. For the rest of us, big picture time. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the story from New York.
Let's go back to 2007 with Karen Petru, managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. I asked her, what were the top three things that big Wall Street banks were making their money on back then?
Subprime mortgages, generating fee income out of the retail banking line, and what I call structured finance.
Meaning all those crazy securitized mortgages and investment vehicles that it turns out aren't as much fun as the banks thought they were. Now, in 2010, Karen Petru, how are banks like J.P. Morgan spending their time?
Risk absorption and management, net interest margin management, and balance sheet rebuilding.
Translation, cleaning up the mess and making money on the difference in interest rates between what they borrow and what they lend. You know, the bank stuff of old Hollywood movies. Jamie Peters, a banking analyst at Morningstar, says the other things depressing earnings this quarter are new rules about how much cash banks have to hold in case of losses.
They're trying to navigate the waters of additional capital and yet at the same time trying to maintain profitability for their shareholders.
Which it appears they were able to do today, even in this new era of banking.
J.P. Morgan right now is a lot less profitable than they were pre-crisis, and they're a lot less profitable than they're going to be probably in a couple of years.
That, she says, is because in the third quarter of 2010, the credit crisis isn't in the rearview mirror for banks just yet. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Wall Street traders were a happy group today. Higher corporate profits do tend to do that. And a few stocks got more attention than Apple. But if you want a slice, it's going to cost you $301.96 per slice or share at one point this morning. That makes the maker of the iPod, the iPad, and everything else the second most valuable company in the American economy as measured by market capitalization. Only ExxonMobil beats it. And that is a pretty lofty position to be in. So we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to explain exactly why market cap matters.
A quick refresher. Market cap is essentially how much a company is worth. It's the number of shares times the stock price. In Apple's case, that total is $275 billion.
Well, what it represents is the public opinion poll of the market.
James Angel is a finance professor at Georgetown's business school.
It says that the market thinks this company is really valuable, and the market thinks this company is going to generate lots of sales and cash flows for many years to come.
Angel says all that confidence is nice, but it can be daunting. He says if he were Apple, he'd be nervous right now about living up to expectations.
They've had so many successes that will the market be disappointed if their next creative endeavor is not the great smashing success that the iPhone has been?
What the size of a company's market capitalization can't tell you is how well a company's run or how successful it's going to be. After all, General Motors was once among the largest cap stocks in the country. Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist at Wells Capital Management. He says large cap companies tend to be more mature than smaller ones, so there's less room to grow.
If you're the largest market cap stock or one of them, you don't get that way by being a small, innovative company. I mean, you were at one point, but you're not at this point anymore.
He says if a stock gets too popular, it might scare away investors.
Maybe too popular right now to buy, if you will.
We'll get another take on how well Apple is doing on Monday when the company reports quarterly earnings. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
There are, by most estimates, as many as 1 million illegal immigrants here in Los Angeles. They pose a number of challenges to social services and education and law enforcement. Specifically, should cops protect or prosecute? The question was complicated a bit yesterday when county officials extended a program that identifies undocumented immigrants in county jails and turns them over to the federal government. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
At the Los Angeles County Jail, after inmates are convicted, they're interviewed about their immigration status. That information is turned over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. L.A. County Sheriff's Department spokesman Steve Whitmore says about 20% of the jail inmates are in the U.S. illegally. Turning them over to Immigration Enforcement could save real money because it shifts the cost of incarceration over to the feds.
When you figure that it costs about $80 to $90 million a year to house the 20% population out of the 16,000 to 18,000 we have in our jails, the cost savings is many millions of dollars.
Angelica Salas is with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles. She understands the financial incentive for the Sheriff's Department.
Almost all local law enforcement agents that are seeing incredible cuts are looking for any way by which to increase their revenue.
But Salas says the program makes communities less safe. She says people have been calling her organization's hotline when they should be dialing 911.
We have individuals who have been victims of robbery, who have been victims of sexual assault. And before the family calls their local law enforcement agent, they're calling our hotline because they want to be assured that they won't be turned over to ICE if they report this crime.
That distrust isn't likely to change soon. Deportations have been increasing significantly. In the last fiscal year, Immigration and Customs Enforcement removed a record-breaking number of undocumented aliens. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, rising corporate profits lifted most boats. Anyway, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Walmart does everything big. It's the world's biggest retailer. It's got the world's biggest supply chain. Even its stores are huge. The average Walmart Supercenter store comes in at 200,000 square feet. But to everything, there is a natural end. Walmart announced a new strategy today. Smaller stores inside American cities, not out where you have to drive half an hour to get to them. From KJZZ in Phoenix, Peter O'Dowd reports.
Forget big box. Walmart is moving to shoebox. Bill Simon is the CEO of Walmart US.
There are hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of opportunities in the US for small formats.
Simon spoke to investors and analysts this morning.
Many, many, many of them exist in markets where we have no market share or next to no market share.
He says these smaller formats will show up in America's urban core, from New York to California and places in between. Though he was short on details, Simon said even small towns that can't support a supercenter will get a look at the new concept.
After years of development, we're now prepared to accelerate the growth of this size store.
The company has experimented with smaller grocery stores. Walmart will use that experience as it opens the initial round of 40 mid-sized stores that will be somewhere between 30,000 and 60,000 square feet. Eventually, the chain will go even smaller than that.
It is a risk.
Morningstar analyst R.J. Hottovy.
But at the same time, I don't think they're losing sight of the core business that they've been known for. I think this is just a new avenue of growth that the company is exploring.
After a long recession, sales at existing Walmart stores have edged downward for several consecutive quarters. Even Walmart says this concept is a key to drive future growth.
It makes sense. Discount is the darling. You know, it's the cachet.
This is Faith Hope Consolo. She's with Prudential Douglas Elliman, a commercial real estate firm in New York. She says it's no secret that Walmart has eyed New York City and its millions of untapped consumers for years.
And they've been looking at this a very long time. They didn't just wake up yesterday morning and say, oh, great, I want to be on 33rd Street and 5th Avenue in Manhattan.
Analysts say urban stores bring in far more sales per square foot than their suburban counterparts. But Walmart's effort has failed in New York City, in part because the chain has faced fierce political opposition. Critics say Walmart abuses employees with low pay and inadequate benefits. At the investors' meeting, Walmart VP Leslie Dock acknowledged the possibility of further conflict as the urban strategy moves into other U.S. cities.
We know that all politics is local in this country. That we're going to have to fight that fight everywhere we go.
And it appears Walmart is gearing up for another try at New York. Faith Hope Consolo says Walmart has been talking to real estate companies, including hers, about smaller sites in all of New York's five boroughs. And she says landlords are paying attention.
Listen, if they ring the phone and they say, hi, I'm Walmart, I want to look at your site, you don't walk to meet them, you run to meet them.
Walmart is not the only big retailer that's jumped into the smaller format. This fall, Target announced its own strategy to open about a dozen urban stores with a footprint of less than 100,000 square feet, starting with Seattle in 2012. Susan Retta follows the industry for the National Retail Federation.
The desire to build huge stores is beginning to wane.
Retta says customers are losing patience, too.
Consumers don't want to spend their days walking up and down the aisles of stores that are the size of a football field.
Retta says this is driving retailers to reconsider the way they've been doing business. So don't expect as many flat-screen TVs at your urban market. Think groceries instead. I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Democrats have their hands full with this fall's elections. The party that's in power right now is doing all it can to keep things that way. And that includes a line of attack that has only the loosest relationship with the truth, specifically that Republicans are getting campaign money from foreign companies laundered through the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Commentator David Frum has two observations and a conclusion.
Republicans offer two counters to the Democratic attack. First, it's evidence-free. While Democrats argue that it's hypothetically possible that Chamber of Commerce money comes from abroad, hypothetically possible is a bad basis for an attack ad. Second, the Democrats have their own foreign funding, U.S. affiliates of foreign corporations like defense contractor Rolls-Royce. But these charges and countercharges miss a bigger story. What is the core evil of the whole U.S. system of campaign finance? It's hard to imagine anybody saying it's that foreigners have too much influence. Here's my nominee. Candidates spend too much time raising money and are too beholden to their donors. You give me cash, I do what you want. Most of the campaign finance reforms adopted since 1974 have made it more difficult for candidates to raise money, which is totally perverse. The candidates now spend even more time at the job and are even more beholden to their donors. A half century ago, it was the parties that raised the money and then distributed the funds to their candidates. Candidates did not necessarily even know where the money was coming from. What changed? Back in the 1940s, to combat abuses in the old party system, we imposed tight limits on the ability of parties to transfer money to candidates. Those limits did not keep pace with the cost of campaigning. To meet their expenses, candidates went into the fundraising business directly. They used to be the talent. Now they must also produce and direct the show. But what if we removed the caps on what parties can give their nominees? Let the parties give candidates as much as they need, $1 million, $2 million, whatever it costs. Let the candidates then spend their time learning the issues, giving speeches, and kissing babies. Legislators would legislate, party leaders would fundraise. Not perfect, but better than what we have now.
David Frum was a speechwriter for the second President Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Next week in this spot, Robert Reich. In the meanwhile, send us your thoughts. Best way to do that is through our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. A bit later in the program, novelist Elmore Leonard says there is an upside to being the bad guy.
I mean, if he can rob a bank, if he can rob 150 banks before he gets caught, you think, wow, hey, He's pretty good.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials climbed 75 points today, 0.2%, closed at 11,096. The NASDAQ rose 23 points, nearly 1%, finished at 2,441. The S&P 500 inched up 8 points, 0.7%, closed at 1,178. Fourth day of gains for the S&P, by the way. Railroad operator CSX steamed ahead more than 4% after reporting stronger than expected quarterly results late yesterday. Caterpillar plowed up more than 1%. Signs of a narrowing Chinese trade surplus helped industrial shares today. But just because markets finished strongly didn't mean the same for stocks of some companies with tidy earnings. J.P. Morgan Chase, where we started today, they unloaded 1.3%. Intel powered down 2.3% today. The 10-year T-note rose. The yield fell to 2.42%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for September. Groundbreaking takes place in Washington at the site of the future National Law Enforcement Museum. And here's the situation. President Obama gets real at a town hall-style meeting with MTV. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
Welcome back to Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, when the economy's lousy and government deficits are high, a certain fairly predictable set of things starts to happen. Social services get cut, education gets cut, and people start talking about cutting defense spending. That's where we are here, talking about trimming the Pentagon's budget to bring down the deficit. Over in the UK, defense cuts are a whole lot closer, which has led to another fairly predictable thing happening, the backlash. Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains.
Honor guard! Salute!
Another British soldier returns home from Afghanistan in a hearse. A few dozen veterans line the route as an honor guard to pay their respects. But after the cortege passes, the sadness turns to anger. The old men voice their bitter opposition to the cuts.
It's a disgrace, actually, that they have to stoop so low. They cut the military, and I think it's disgrace, like, you know.
I think it's a crying shame.
Who's going to defend the country if they take all the defence cuts? I think it's disgusting.
At the Conservative Party annual conference last week, the man who will make the cuts, Defence Secretary Liam Fox, was defensive.
I didn't come into politics wishing to see a reduction in the defence budget. Indeed, there is a strong case to increase our spending on national security.
But he said the government must cut the budget deficit and spending will only be reduced after a thorough defence review assessing the country's strategic needs. Conservative activist Mark Allott says the party is not reassured.
I think the party is particularly concerned that it is being budget rather than security-led. It's not necessarily going to focus on what our security threats are of the United Kingdom, but it's about delivering a certain number that the Treasury is looking for.
That number is reported to be about $12 billion, a huge cut of almost 20%. Some really major items of defence spending are in the firing line.
The weapons officer has my permission to fire.
You have permission to fire.
And that includes the most powerful weapon in Britain's armoury, its so-called independent nuclear deterrent.
Send away.
The US Trident submarine launch nuclear missile system will soon need renewing at a cost of $30 billion. This could be a candidate for a cut, says Dan Plesch of the Centre for International Studies and Diplomacy. It's not independent. It can only be used with US agreement.
And I think increasingly people feel that this is not value for money. And I think people realize that really the spending is a significant subsidy to the American nuclear weapons industry.
Nevertheless, few analysts believe that Britain will junk the missile system, although its renewal might well be delayed. Other, even more drastic cuts have been suggested. In order to save two new aircraft carriers from the axe, it's been reported that Navy chiefs offered to give up more than 20 warships. That would reduce the British fleet to its smallest size since the reign of Henry VIII. Washington is watching the cuts closely, says Alex Nicol of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
And the US Defence Secretary Bob Gates has repeatedly bemoaned the fall in defence spending in Europe and basically sees it as being Europe copping out of its responsibilities around the world.
He says the Pentagon will be worried if, as expected, UK defence spending falls below 2% of GDP, the minimum officially required by NATO. Former Defence Secretary Michael Portillo says Britain's special relationship with the US and its global standing will suffer.
We're going to emerge from this economic crisis, taking a step down, I think, in our influence in the world.
On the guard! Down! Parade! Dismiss!
Another honour guard for another casualty from Afghanistan. The one grim consolation for the old soldiers taking part here is that because the army is at war and losing personnel, the army is politically unassailable. It seems likely to emerge unscathed from the spending cuts. In Oxford, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As of today, there are 21 ships being held by pirates off the coast of Somalia. That's the stretch of the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean leading into and out of the Suez Canal, so it's a pretty busy piece of water. About 22,000 ships cross it every year, billions of dollars worth of cargo, hundreds of billions of dollars, quite possibly. Tempting targets for people with guns and boats and very little to lose. Piracy and that corner of the world are at the center of Elmore Leonard's new novel, Djibouti, it's called. Mr. Leonard, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You write about mobsters and gangsters and bank robbers and all those guys. Where did pirates come from in this book?
I started to read about the Somali pirates off the coast of East Africa, and I thought, wait, what's going on here? Because they all had already hijacked a number of ships, and they didn't call it hijacking. They call it taxing.
Yeah.
Taxing foreign merchandise that was going through their area, 20,000 ships a year going both ways. So they were just set up to go after him in their little speedboats with their automatic weapons, and they were all high. They all were chewing cot.
It's interesting because these guys, these pirates and all the characters in this book, they fit kind of a theme that I think you see in a lot of your books, that everybody that you write about is they're hustling, man. They're trying to, you know, work the system and make things work their way, right? I mean, something about that appeals to you.
Well, there is. But of course, they're trying to do it without working. And yet they put...
Aren't we all?
And yet they have to put in longer hours. They have to work harder to get away from a job.
You know, sometimes when you write, you have your heroes who are... criminals, right? They're bad guys. I'm thinking Jack Foley and Out of Sight, the George Clooney character. But the fact is that bad guys aren't always bad guys, right? I mean, George Clooney is a charming kind of fellow.
That's right. And you want to root for him. When you get someone who had been a bank robber, for example, George Clooney, he robs banks. Well, now he's not robbing banks. But you never know. And that's the beauty of that kind of a character. He's on the fence.
What is it, though, about the shadier characters that is so appealing to you?
Well, I think we're all interested in bad guys, people who get away with things, unless they're really nasty. I couldn't write about serial killers because I have to have an antagonist who can be funny, whether he's talking to his mother or See, I think about that, that this bad guy has a mother. Well, I can do something with that, that is unexpected.
It sounds a little bit like you admire the guys who can get away with this stuff.
Well, if it's George Clooney, yes, certainly.
So clearly, you're a guy who reads the news. You keep up on events. I mean, that's reflected in Djibouti in your new book. So the financial crisis and the economy and the recession, I mean, there's got to be a book in there for you.
No.
Really? Oh, come on.
Where's the action?
Wall Street, center of the financial universe. Jamie Dimon is a bad guy.
I know.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, but I don't write that. My people don't have stock. I think it's the most boring thing in the world to make your money that way, using money to make money.
You don't think there's some, entry-level person that you could find, you could make the, I don't know. I don't know why I'm pitching you a book.
Well, if you get a good idea, let me know about it.
I'll do that. Well, Elmore Leonard, his most recent book is Djibouti. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We've got the first chapter of Djibouti on our website, just as a teaser for you, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend, offering four sections of ideas and information available at newsstands every Saturday. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out this afternoon, we saw an article about this pizza chain over in England this morning. Apparently, it's hired a trained classical actor to teach employees how to flirt, theory being that that would get customers to order more. Perfect fodder, we thought, for the marketplace players.
Welcome to Pizza Express. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate.
Thanks.
I think he's talking to me, honey.
May I recommend the bruschetta to start for the lady? And may I compare thine countenance to the lovely sea, glittering, soft, shrouding hidden depths?
Or can we just order?
Bruschetta sounds lovely. And the prosciutto and mozzarella pizza?
And that's it.
Of course. A woman of such obvious passions wouldn't dare risk igniting her lust with wine.
And a bottle of Pinot.
To go.
For here.
Yeah, we're just going to go because we got to get out of here. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow jumped 75 points, largely on stronger corporate profit reports. That is 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ up 23 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 bumped up 8 points, 0.7%. Mahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this radio show, our series Economy 4.0 is back.
I do like numbers a lot. I am the numbers geek of the office.
A better way to measure how the economy is working. I'm Kai Rizdal. Please join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.